Hello everyone, this is Tony, Network Chief of We Made This. As you know, our podcast network brings together a brilliant assortment of talent who talk about all kinds of pop culture content, such as the episode you just listened to, or maybe you're just about to listen to. We're not going anywhere, but we'd love to keep the lights on for even longer if you're able to support our network on Patreon. For just £2 a month, you get your name in lights and the satisfaction of knowing you're helping us produce more great audio. And for £3 a month, you'll get your name in lights, but you'll also get access to an exclusive bi-monthly podcast from the We Made This talent pool on podcasting, pop culture, and, well, you tell us. We'll take your suggestions. For less than the price of a coffee per month, you can help keep We Made This going. Just head to patreon.com/WeMadeThis. That's patreon.com/WeMadeThis. And get the ball rolling. Now, back to your scheduled programming.
Welcome to the Starlight Ballroom. Hey!
We Made This.
Hello and welcome to Shipwrecked and Comatose, the podcast about Red Dwarf here on the We Made This podcast network. We are into our coverage of Series 5 with Series 5 Episode 3, Terraform. My name's Mark and I'm your regular host, and with me at this time, as always, is Kurt North. Hello, Kurt.
Hello. Current condition, mauve.
I like it. And our guest host for the next two episodes is Matt Latham. Hello, Matt.
Hi.
What's your current condition?
Head and shoulders.
I like it.
That was quick, that was. Okay, good. So we're covering Terraform, which is Series 5, Episode 3. And that was first broadcast on the 12th of March, 1992. Someone went on Wikipedia. Why do we do that? Why do we actually bother? Does anyone give a monkeys when it was first broadcast?
Yes.
Yes.
Because we even talk about it in the episode. We're like, when was this said? Oh, it's 1992 when they said. It was such and such. So yes, it does.
Yeah, because it makes sense, because you can't be talking about 90s ick if it aired in like 2021, could you?
Well, it's Red Dwarf Series 5. It definitely didn't air in 2020. Well, it may be on UK Gold. Do we even get UK Gold?
No, is it's now dead? Dave.
Oh, is that right? Is Dave it's
all those channels dead, Dave.
It's now Dave dead.
UK Gold is dead, Dave.
UK Gold is dead. It's Dave. UK Gold is dead. It's Dave.
Oh, as if I watch live telly. Literally, this year, the only thing I've watched live is the Eurovision Song Contest.
Nil pois.
That's what we got.
Yeah, I was on a Zoom drinking night last night when it was airing, and the first thing I saw about the Eurovision Song Contest was a picture and just the Great Britain, nil pois. Like, okay, that makes sense.
He took it like a champ, though. I mean,
yeah, I've seen some videos since then. Yeah,
I mean, it was inevitable anyway, but it didn't help that the song was cack. Like, literally the worst of the night, regardless of bias.
Okay,
we have. Did you like it?
I've only your word to take because, as I say, I wasn't watching it, so.
Okay. Right.
Thought it was better than Switzerland, so.
Oh, Switzerland's was wretched. But we're not a Eurovision podcast. We are a Red Dwarf podcast. Should we talk about Terraform?
Yes, let's do that.
It opens up with Starbuck that has crashed and Crichton is in a wreck with 67 minutes of runtime left. He makes a log, but knows nothing due to his short-term memory being erased. His short-term memory is also erased. Eventually, he works out that his short-term memory has been erased because his short-term memory has been erased. And then he creates a mecha spider with his hand and one of his eyes, and he sends it to get help.
Do you know, it's that whole computer scene, you know, going through his visuals, the Terminator Robocop kind of aspect of it. Some of the stuff in there is really good. It's like when it says, check in trading price against a Series 5000 model. That tickled me because I've always seen it, but I've never actually like took time to read them, bits of it.
Yeah.
I've obviously seen little bits, you know, things like refer to qualified service personnel or, you know, as I say, like my joke at the beginning, the condition mauve, and I think it goes like, what was it, helio. It goes to magenta at some point and stuff like that.
Marigold.
Yeah, marigold at one point. Yeah.
Torp.
But if he's got no legs and he's got 67 minutes to live, I'm not sure mauve covers it. That's red. That is definitely red.
But it would mean changing the bulb, sir. But
we're not there yet.
And there's the spider.
Yeah.
Is really quite cute. You know how, like, the Pixar lamp shouldn't be cute? It's a fucking lamp. I felt the same about this spider. It's a kind of horribly damaged hand with an eye on the end. It shouldn't be cute, but there's something about it that's really cute.
It's a means to an end. I think it's done wonderfully because when we get to the next scene where it's on Red Dwarf, it's the sheer terror that those two are having. And then when the spider comes up and you've got that sound design, which is the first thing, which is when you hear it right at the beginning going, like does that. It's perfect because it's like, you know, the fact that, oh, what's going on? What's going on? Oh, yeah, follow me kind of thing. And it's just absolutely great, opposite ends of the spectrum from terror to fun. And I think it's wonderfully done. And that sound effect for the eye is just brilliant.
Yeah, it's really cute. And credit to the people who make the models. You know, they've done great stuff with Starbug and Red Dwarf and even the Hollow Ship in the past. But to make something that can actually move like a remote control thing, that's pretty cool.
Something that I wanted to mention as well, the fact that that scene, we've talked, Mark, over the last couple of episodes. I know that, obviously, Matt, you haven't heard them yet, but we're talking about the kind of production of these episodes and Juliet May coming on board to direct. But what kind of threw me a little bit watching season 5 recently is that there's a lot more pre-records, but it doesn't feel like it's a detriment to the episode. So, like, sort of Crichton during this scene, It was obviously recorded on a set, but nobody was there, and they actually showed it to somebody. Later on in this episode, the scenes where it's recorded and then showed to the audience. But I don't have as much of an issue with it than I might have done in earlier episodes or in much later episodes. And it just feels like it's they've kind of got the strike of the right balance between having the studio audience in there on certain scenes and then all the pre-recorded, all the set stuff is actually done so well that it's not something that you instantly comes to mind about the fact that it's not waiting for that joke like we've had in seasons 1 and 2, for example, where, you know, they'll deliver a line and they have to wait for the audience. It doesn't feel forced.
Yeah, that does make sense. I'm not very good at spotting what's live and what's not personally, but yes, now you've pointed it out, that does make sense.
Yeah, I think as well it is. I think mainly it's because of the staging of the camera and just how much stuff's going on in terms of the design of it. So you've got Robert Llewellyn pretty much into a slightly alternative version of the usual makeup in rubble. That must have taken absolutely ages to set up and to get him in there.
Yeah.
And I'm assuming that watching that live wouldn't be the most exciting experience because it probably took ages to set that up before the recording stuff.
Yeah.
So I never realized whether it was recorded live or in front of the audience or recorded separately on like a soundstage or something. But thinking about it, I mean, like the practicality of it, it just must be that you can't have like Tony Hawk talking into the audience as a warm up band for about 2 hours whilst you're seeing Robert Llewellyn being dropped into this rubble.
Yeah.
So,
yeah, and it's the age old thing of the way the set designed that you've got him obviously with false legs and the legs being underneath and sort of designed on top of that and stuff like that. So I can imagine it being quite a setup. But as I say, I think just purely off in other episodes, you can feel the audience isn't there. And I think it goes to, I think Mark, or you might have said this last episode, that it feels more sci-fi, like it feels like it's a bit more, slightly more budget, more sci-fi, and it doesn't throw you off. And with the fact that you've not even noticed, and I haven't really noticed until like looking at it with more critical eye, that it fits where they are in Red Dwarf lore anyway. It fits right now, so it doesn't feel a detriment to the show at all. And I think it's really done well because of these sci-fi elements that they are actually using now.
Yeah, and like you mentioned, with all the stuff that was going on backstage, Series 5 really should have been inferior to the previous four, but yeah, it's fantastic, isn't it?
I think it's better than 4.
Yeah, so do I.
Yeah.
Because I think, my previous appearance, I think my viewing, and since rewatching it again since recording in the lead up to this as well, I think my view is that the memory of 4 is better than the quality of 4, if that makes sense.
Yeah.
I mean, 4's got its highs, and I think it's got its more memorable episodes. But I think then, like, you have like episodes like Meltdown, and which I think are completely forgotten about. And to its credit, season 5, I think, is actually stronger as a whole overall. Even though I think my overall feelings on this episode is that, I mean, I love this episode, but I think it's the weakest of the series, 5 so far, is that I think that generally, I think the groove that people think of when they think of series four and 6, for example, I think series 5 actually has that, whereas I think rose-tinted glasses of 4 can kind of mask some of the more different elements of season 4 that I wasn't much a fan of. It's like when I rewatched Backwards and I was like, I remember Backwards being better than it actually is in terms of plotting and stuff.
Yeah.
So yeah, I think 5's like the first series, the first series from this, like, the 3 to 6 era, the second era of Red Dwarf, where it kind of, it matches my memory of it.
Yeah. Yeah, that makes a lot of sense. I think 4 was a smidge disappointing. But I tell you something that I've noticed watching Series 5 as we've gone along. It's Series 1 to 4 that I've got most of my quotable Red Dwarf from. Mm. But it was Series 5 and 6 that I absolutely loved. So I thought all my quotable Red Dwarf would be from my favourite series, but that's not the case. I don't think there's a quotable dwarf in this episode. There is next episode, but I don't think there is in this one.
It's a very, I mean, at this point, Red Dwarf is a very good, well, not good, interesting series of, the word I've got in my head is contradictions, but I don't think that's the right word, where you have, like, it's got a reputation and you got the things that people know it for, but then when you look into the minutiae of the episodes of how it's structured or some of the comedy, you find that its best parts go pretty much against what the common perception of it is. Like, I mean, this Series 5 is probably the closest it's got to toppling Series 2 in my list of favourite series, but I think on a rewatch, Series 2 I think holds stronger, but it's a lot more character based and doesn't have the sci-fi elements that it's known for in the 3 to 6 era. But then you look back and some of Series 2 is some of the strongest character work.
Yeah,
it has in it. And like, I think Series 5, and particularly with this episode as well, kind of tries to get that balance. And I think it does it quite well.
The spider enters Red Dwarf and Holly tells Lister that there's an alien spider on board. And it's at this point we find out that Lister is desperately scared of tarantulas. Cat enters just as the spider grabs Lister's leg. Lister and Cat communicate via the computer text and the spider climbs up his leg. Eventually, the spider gets to the keyboard and it tells them about Crichton and asks them to follow. And I love the reference to the dumb adventure game that the cat says, which is possibly one of the most datingest datingnesses of all of the things we've watched in Red Dwarf.
Are you saying that text adventures are dumb, Mark?
I'm not. No, the cat says that text adventures are dumb. I quite like them, but I'm old. And I do feel like they don't really happen anymore, though. This is like a Spectrum level of kind of video game, isn't it?
Yeah, I'm not going to get onto my adventure game. I'm not going to go on the tangent, but they're not dead. They're not dead. They're pretty much alive if you know where to look. But yeah, I mean, in terms of the datedness, it's the what's quite interesting, and on the tongue-tied wiki as well, they also brought this back where sometimes the contradiction of Red Dwarf that I mentioned kind of falls back on itself, where it's a set in the future, but as you watch it 30 years after it comes out, you start to see some of the sci-fi elements get a bit outdated. Mm-hmm. So, for example, like, there's a brilliant kind of, one of the more funny things on Back to Earth, which I know you haven't watched, which kind of takes the piss out of that, which won't go into detail that much. But like, for example, but it's to do with like the fact that VHSs are available still in like on the Red Dwarf, and yeah. The Tongue Tied Wiki also points out that considering that he was built in like the 24th century, Crichton shouldn't really be affected by magnetic coils, because that was like a reference to the fact that floppy disks could get absolutely buggered if you put them next to a speaker.
I didn't think of that.
Yeah.
But it is a massive contradiction that in this episode, they're playing specky games, and then in 3 episodes' time, they're on the most advanced virtual reality you've ever seen. It's interesting, isn't it? But it does work really well for the gag. I feel like the text and then the expressions on the actors' faces, that is so fucking funny. And as a gag goes, it works really, really well. So fuck it looking dated.
Well, you see, I mean, I think those type of adventure games are dead. Rocket Pants, they are dead. Matt, they are dead. They're dead, Matt. Matt, they're dead.
But even the ones written in Twine?
They're dead.
Even the ones written in the Avenger Game Studio?
Yep, they're dead. They're dead, Matt.
All of them?
They're dead, Matt.
Fuck's sake, you two.
But I would take a headcanon viewpoint of that it's something that Lister might have looked back at as, like, he found this kind of archaeological dig of these type of games. And that Kat's basically saying, you've become obsessed with those type of games in recent history. And he's just gone, are you playing one of those games that you found from the 1980s? You know, it's now whatever year it is there.
Yeah.
So,
headcanon.
Go on.
My headcanon, the Jupiter Mining Corporation is absolutely full of tight-fisted board members who can't be bothered to shell out for the latest versions of stuff. So, for example, like when you go to a hotel or a guest house, and they've got like DVDs or videos from the 80s, and they've never bothered to buy any more for the guests.
Yeah.
So, like, and like they got a version of Risk, and it's got Prussia on it. That's how outdated it is. I'm just assuming that it could be the case that Jupiter Mining Corporation hasn't got the budget to fit the latest entertainment things in, or if they do, it's just for the officers. So, like, the officers have got your virtual reality bollocks, whereas all the chicken shoot machine technicians can't have access to the prestige stuff. So they have to go and load their C64s because they're not officer level to be able to have a PlayStation 5 or something like that.
PlayStation 5s, remember them? Remember when they were like the big thing? And there was this big Microsoft versus Sony thing. I mean, that was so long ago.
Microsoft, weren't they the one that caused that pandemic in like the 2030s or something?
Yeah, they tagged everyone through a vaccine or something, I believe. So it was daunting times.
You two are on fucking form today. I'm glad you're leading the next episode, Kurt, because I'm going to be a right arse. Lister gets to Crichton to rescue him, and he has to cut him in two. Crichton warns him that that will invalidate his warranty. And this is just so fucking Crichton. I really just giggle at this.
I wish I did like that.
It's so deadpan and so completely blunt and just perfect Crichton moment that I really enjoyed.
Okay, so I'm going to say something. I know that Matt hasn't seen the Smegups, but I think what's replaced for me, Quotable Red Dwarf, has been Smegup Red Dwarf, where every time I think see an episode around this era, it instantly reminds me of another. So like Meltdown, like we said last season, with the whole, it's knocking on the chimney and it's wood. And he's like, look, stone, and he knocks on it. This one for me is when he's drilling, and he's not drilling, he's using the welding machine, and he puts his thing down. And there's a woman off screen goes, no, you need to put your helmet down. And he says, I can't, and Craig Charles goes, well, I can't see. And the woman says, it's all right. He says, no one will know. I says, what do you mean no one will fucking know? I might cut my knob off. No one will see. It's just brilliant. It's just like just a complete brilliant outtake of, like, you know, the fact is he wants to look after his genitalia at the end of the day. He doesn't want to, like, properly.
I think
chop
we
it
need
off.
To do the Smeg up soon, Kurt, because every time you mention one of these, the memory suddenly comes back. And you're absolutely right. It's almost like your version of Quotable Dwarf.
Yeah.
Because I never really did that, but when you mention it, I'm like, oh shit, yeah, that's Smeg up and that's Smeg up. So let's do the Smeg up soon.
Yes, I think it's appropriate time because it's when they first, because as I say, they're all coming into full swing now. There's so many of them around this era.
So back on Starbug, and Lister has fixed Crichton, but there are some missing parts. They ask about Rimmer, but Crichton's memory files are damaged. But what he does remember is that they claimed a planet for the Space Corps and the planet terraformed, and then he remembers Rimmer being in great pain and then getting abducted. Holly, on this information, manages to track Rimmer and they head out to rescue him. They travel through the swamps, and Crichton speculates that they're on a Psi moon that has terraformed into a world that represents Rimmer's mind, and that if it's true, Rimmer will have a physical form and that he is in real danger.
Okay, so this is another scene it's obvious this has been, you know, filmed without an audience because of the kind of on-set thing. A couple of things happened in regards to filming here. They had somebody who it was Craig Charles, you know, the big flames that were in the lake itself. He wanted to light up a cigarette, so he moved the boat over to one of them, and the rest of the crew were like, oh, crap. No, he might set the boat on fire, which he didn't. But then there was somebody, lighting director, John Pomfrey. He was, from the information I've got, setting up some equipment and misjudged where the water was, and some of his equipment actually fell into the lake, including himself.
Shit.
So you can imagine the equipment as well, you know. In fact, at that point, they're not exactly waterproof. I mean, phones aren't really waterproof, you know, to a degree up until recently. So can you imagine all the equipment that you would have, and just to see, like, your video equipment just fall into water, it'd be absolutely horrific.
Yeah, that's an expensive fuck up. Smeg up. That's an expensive smeg up, isn't it?
Yeah.
So Rimmer is being carried in chains by Jawas, or at least something that looks like them, and is then chained to a post in a temple. The Jawas are actually the Hooded Legion, and they announce that he is to be sacrificed to the Unspeakable One. It's at this point that two scantily clad women arrive and strip him quite enthusiastically.
So the two women, the handmaidens, one's Sarah Stockbridge, who was a model. I think the other one was potentially a model as well, Francine Walker-Lee. I actually did a bit of research on them both and found out that Francine Walker-Lee actually died in 1995. She was 31. But I couldn't find any information on why.
That's a shame.
Yeah, so it's the other one, Sarah Stockbridge, she's appeared in a couple of other things, but she is known as a model.
The actually, I did a bit of quick research into Sarah Stockbridge. Do you know what her bacon number is? Bacon number.
No.
So you've I'm assuming that you've heard of the six degrees of Kevin Bacon.
All right. Okay. All right, yeah, I'm with you.
Right, okay, now I'm with you.
I'm with you now.
Yeah, so, and like...
I thought you were saying, it was her baking number? I was like, what?
Bacon. Yeah. It's where I'm from, mate. It's a black country.
Okay.
Bacon. I thought Mark would have been able to understand me, but anyway.
Well, I heard you say bacon. I just didn't know what the fuck you were chatting about.
Story of my life, eh?
Beer can.
So, beer. So, so the Bacon Number, for people who aren't aware, basically there's the game 6 Degrees Kevin Bacon, where someone has theorised that pretty much every single actor or actress in the known world will have at least have a connection of at least 6, or at most 6 degrees of connecting. So, like, you'll go, oh, so-and-so worked with so-and-so on a different film, who then worked with so-and-so, who then worked with Kevin Bacon. And it's quite surprising how quite a lot of small numbers there are. I mean, there's a website called the Oracle of Bacon, which where you can type in any person's name and it gives you the number. Sarah Stockbridge has a Bacon number of 2.
This is fucking ludicrous, Matt.
Yeah, so apparently she was in Interview with the Vampire with Christian Slater.
Right.
And Christian Slater was in Hollow Man 2,
right,
with Kevin Bacon. And I think it's just kind of weird. I mean, I think the kind of mysticism of that is pretty much undercut by the fact that IMDb will go and search for anyone who had like a non-speaking role in any film. So like, it kind of ruins the game a bit. But I just found that quite interesting.
I've probably got quite a good Bacon number, you know, because one of my mates is in the WWE. So if he's wrestled someone that has wrestled The Rock, then that means if The Rock's been in a film with Kevin Bacon, that my Bacon number's only 4.
Okay.
But even if The Rock hasn't been in a film with Kevin Bacon, he's been in a film with someone who's been in a film with Kevin Bacon. I reckon my Bacon number is 4 or 5.
Well, Craig Charles is 3 to Bacon. He was in Ghost Watch with Michael Parkinson, who was in Big Fat Gypsy Gangster with Jeffrey Bell, who was in You Should Have Left with Kevin Bacon.
I want to get... I'm going to look at my... After this, I'm going to look at my Bacon number. If I can make it 4, I'll be quite pleased.
Depends. Are you an IMDb?
It should be.
I'm not on IMDb, no.
Oh, damn it.
Anyway. I am on Cage Match, which is the wrestling equivalent of IMDb. Anyway, Starbuck gets stuck 200 metres away and they have to embark on foot. The women, meanwhile, are oiling Rimmer and he tells them that erotic persuasion won't work until they play with his nipples and he cracks. They then tell him he is now prepared for their master.
Sorry, very, very quick question that I meant to ask a bit earlier in terms of the structure of this episode. This episode is effectively a character study of Rimmer.
Mm-hmm.
Rimmer doesn't actually turn up until about 10 minutes in. Do you think it's effective or not? Watching this, my main thing about it is that I think that perhaps they've had the idea that they wanted to kind of explore Rimmer's kind of psychology, but then they also had this idea that they kind of wanted to do the tarantula joke and like start with like an in media res of Crichton in pieces, but perhaps couldn't meld them together, so they could sort of manage to fix them on. And I think the slight detriment to that is that it kind of loses the anchor of Rimmer as a character, who's, because this is a Rimmer episode, but he doesn't actually show up until a third in. So
they had real problems with the, to going, as you say, going back to the computer scene where he's doing the typing, that was had to be drastically re-edited and cut, because they weren't it wasn't brilliant, but then they've managed to do it in a way that actually makes it a really memorable part of the episode. Because I remember the computer game thing like vividly as a kid watching that. I remember that. It just feels that it feels like there's more. There seems to be more issues, as Mark alluded to before, throughout series 5, where they seem to be like almost putting out fires where they need to, and it causes. I mean, we'll talk about another thing in next week's quarantine episode where there's a few things that have been melded together. But it feels like there's this issue of like things happening behind the scenes, which is like throwing them off kilter a little bit. And I don't know if it's some of it as made, and we talked about how good series five is. Some of it's actually it's come out good. I mean, I know I'll go on about you too, but Joshua Tree, where the streets have no name, they actually managed to, which is one of the obviously the biggest hits they ever had, that they got so badly like trying to record that song that Brian Eno was on the verge of throwing that song out and just starting again. And it was a second hand that actually went, no, don't do that. And then it became one of the biggest songs. And they would have lost that had they just thrown away and just started again. And I think this is what's happening in Red Dwarf here. It feels like they're kind of like, they're just battling these fires and things are coming out of it. But then you've got little things like what you're saying there with not having Rimmer so late into the episode that might well be a slight detriment to it.
I don't know. I think that this episode isn't that dissimilar to what we've seen in the past, where you have it almost in two parts, where you have funny thing that then causes the other thing that's the second half of the show. Like, I'm crap at remembering which one's which, but there's the episode where they have the self-destruct that's been disconnected and it ends up being a toffee crisp. Yeah. And then that becomes something else for the rest of the episode. What episode is that?
It's the Simpsons plotting, isn't it?
Mm. Like, yeah, that's a good point of putting it.
The Simpsons, once you get to a certain point, I think like season three or something, it's the detached act one structure where it kind of misleads you to the actual episode plot. I just think from what we've seen in the past in terms of how quite tightly plotted they are, I just find it quite interesting that sometimes Red Dwarf has gone through that and where it's been a lot better at uniting like thematically what the episode's about. So I mean, because the visual impact of Crichton, I think completely makes you forget. They hardly mention Rimmer. You don't realise he's there until he's not. Well, you don't realise he's not there until much, much later.
I mean, you've got to have that scene because you've got to get Rimmer away from the crew, don't you? And there's no other way of getting him away without having that crash. So it's whether or not with the two big set pieces of, you know, you've got the Lassie moment with the hand to get them to move over. And those two scenes are quite chunky. They're quite, you know, there's a lot of meat on them. So it's like whether or not, and if the second one, like I was saying with the computer one, was quite of, it was quite a bad recording. They've messed around with, and actually became the edit in which it became, and it was meaty, and this first part's meaty as well. Is it just a case of like, you know, were they not really ready to kill the darlings? As many people would say, the fact there was too much good stuff in there, and they just didn't want to cut anything else out of it, and that's why you've just got to the moment, because it could well be that they didn't envisage how long those two first scenes are or were going to be.
True.
So the boys are in a canoe and they are observed by the Hooded Legion. I have put Jawas in my notes, but Hooded Legion. The frog's ribbit is useless, and leeches have Rimmer's mum's face. Crichton finds a graveyard with traits of his personality that are dead: self-respect, generosity, self-confidence, honour, and charm. And more importantly, there's a freshly dug grave for hope. And Crichton says, if that's filled, they'll all be trapped on the Simoon.
Yeah, the mother thing is a nice callback, I think, because I have a mental image of that when he says it. So it's Red Dwarf at this point is working by using like in canon things that's already happened. Oh, it's Rimmer's mum, and it also has that that almost callback to the Winnie the Pooh moment as well. So you know, so it's that that humour, and it's like I always go back to this in some form in some way, and I don't think I've done it in five series of Shipwrecked and Comatose. Is that I'll always refer back to one of the biggest BBC complaints ever was for Spooks when Lisa Faulkner got her head put into a chip fryer and the amount of people complained about it. But
I never actually watched that past that episode. I think I was, what, 11 or 12 when it aired. And I don't think that physically scarred me after. I just found it quite hilarious that I started watching Spooks at that episode.
Yeah, I think it was the second episode or something.
Yeah.
But the actual thing about it was, for those people who haven't seen that TV show, is that the BBC got so many complaints about it because they said it was obscene seeing it and things, but you didn't actually see it. It was the sound design. It was everything like sort of in your head that you could feel it. And I think that to a much different level, the fact that you can't, and they're not going to computer generate Rimmer's mother on a little blood sucking thing. But your mind works really well to actually put that into your head, to actually physically imagine that happening. Same with the Winnie the Pooh moment.
And it's also, we criticise Red Dwarf for its crap continuity. You've got to remember, Lister's had sex with Rimmer's mum. He definitely knows what she looks like.
Yeah. Yeah, that's true. That's true.
Alphabetti spaghetti, don't forget.
In terms, so this is the exact one examples of like having a kind of literal exploration of Rimmer as a character. So in terms of like how like he lacks like self-respect and generosity, and I think quite recently at the time recording, I've not recorded the episode yet, but before this I was doing quite a bit of research into the first series of The British Empire, but by the time this has come out the special would have been recorded and released, I believe, and there was quite a lot of interesting articles of people comparing Gordon Britus and Rimmer, and a bunch of people saying, oh, they're the same character, that is this and this and stuff. But what rewatching this after watching the first series of British Empire, I think demonstrates how different they are, and pretty much getting a better appreciation of how Chris Barry portrays Rimmer as a character, particularly when you compare the physicality of Gordon Britus. And it's to the point where it started to annoy me, where people were saying, oh, they're just the same character but in different time zones. But they're not.
I think there's some similarities in their complete and utter lack of social, in their complete and utter social ineptitude, but they are different characters, and I think that's an unfair comparison.
Yeah, so stuff like self-confidence and honour, and like, for example, self-confidence, I think, I think Gordon Britus, the original intent, I think, is that's supposed to be kind of like, he sees himself as a selfless kind of like guide who wants to help people and will, and kind of wants to see himself, as like a visionary or a tutor or a mentor for people, and so that people can go, I'm here because of Gordon Britus. Whereas Rimmer would probably want to get to that stage, but doesn't really give a shit about anyone. Or if he does reference, or if a child goes, Admiral Rimmer, you're the reason that I joined the Space Corps, Rimmer will just take that smug and then just completely forget about it and just feel good about himself. Whereas Gordon Britus would actually take that and think he's actually achieved something, and probably would accept. I mean, this is like own unique way, but he'd have that. He'd be a bit more selfless with the praise, I think. Whereas, so that's just been in my head. That's just been in my head recently because of, in the lead up to the British Empire, I've just reading so much about how apparently they're the same character more or less. And I think it just started to slightly annoy me. Apparently there's a fan fiction which part of me wants to try and read, where apparently they've done a Gordon Britus and Rimmer swap places. I've been trying to find it actually, but apparently it ends up with them switching back, and apparently Lister and Crichton and that saying they much preferred Rimmer to Britus, which I probably could understand actually, because I think as much as Rimmer doesn't have that kind of self, he has that self-loathing. We've talked about him. He does have some worth to the crew and stuff. And I think as the episode goes on, we kind of see that.
I think what that really highlights is the expectations of an audience for a sitcom. And yeah. I also watched the first series of Britis recently, and I don't feel like Britis has the level of sophistication that Red Dwarf does. Both yeah. Rimmer and Britis are designed to be the irritating character that is cringy. But I feel like at this point, where we're up to in Red Dwarf, the character of Rimmer is more of a sci-fi character than a sitcom character, because of all the background and all the establishment and all of the neuroses that we've seen. So I don't really think it's even a fair comparison to look mm-hmm. at Rimmer and Britis. Britis is so absurd, whereas mm-hmm. a lot of people can identify with Rimmer. I don't think literally anyone could identify with Britis.
It's, yeah, because it's... Funnily enough, I was thinking about this, that the more realistic character is Rimmer, whereas Britis is an over-exaggeration cartoon.
Yeah, it's like a Basil Fawlty, isn't it?
There are elements of the future series of the British Empire, and that goes to kind of some weird places that Red Dwarf doesn't even go, because it kind of goes beyond reality, whereas like Red Dwarf and science fiction in general has that basis of it could happen. It theoretically possibly could happen. And I think Red Dwarf's always had that kind of thing. So Rimmer is a lot more of a realistic character than perhaps Britis, which is basically the point you were saying, Mark. So I'm sorry if I just repeated what you just said. But
Special on Britis. Should we talk about this?
Yes.
So the unspeakable one comes out of his pit, and Rimmer jabbers at him because he's clearly petrified. The unspeakable one shuts him up and goes for an H-shaped brand, which I think is so fucking good. He then tells him that all his nightmares will come true. The boys from the dwarf are in a crawl space above, and then they see the unspeakable one tell Rimmer that he is his own self-loathing, and Rimmer admits that he hates himself completely, which, do you know, this character has always been the butt of jokes, but my heart broke for Rimmer at that point.
Yeah, no, I completely agree. I think, again, because, I mean, Is this the first time he's explicitly said it? Because I'm pretty sure the implication and the way he spoke about himself has always been there. I mean, he's always kind of talked himself up, but we've seen that's kind of always been a kind of bravado of like self protection, where you kind of psych yourself up for stuff. But I can't remember if this is like the first full time that he's explicitly said that he hates himself.
I don't know. I think that's why Rimmer's such a good character, isn't he? Because you feel for him because he is the way he is, and you know the stuff underneath. Whereas, like, each of the other characters have different, you know, because Lister is like, you obviously, with being the way that he is, he'll always be the heart of the show and will make mistakes. You've got Kat, who's obviously the shallow one. You've got Crichton, you know, trying to be more human, like your data aspect. And Rimmer has always fitted in that there's more to tell. There's a story to tell about Rimmer. And the fact that, you know, you do get episodes like this. You do get episodes where he's in the little dome thing in season two. And, you know, all those, like, heartfelt moments are there. And it's a good dichotomy to have this brash, really pushing for the stars guy, and just, but his backstory is actually really kind of, you know, heartbreaking. So I think that it's really interesting when they delve into Rimmer's character in that way, because it's the only one you could do it for.
I always remember the sitcom Coupling by Stephen Moffat. Yeah. When he first created it, he said that the character archetypes were the fact that you've got the two autobiographical characters of Steve and Susan, Jack Davenport and Sarah Alexander. They're the kind of the level kind of the everyman relatable characters. But then he created the characters of Jeff, Patrick, Jane and Sally to be the extremes. So you've got, so you have the two, you've got the male and female balance. Then you've got Patrick and Jane, who are meant to be the overconfident in themselves characters. And then you've got Jeff and Sally, who are the kind of neurotic other side of that spectrum. And it's only just been now that I'm thinking that the structure of Red Dwarf is very similar with that. Particularly if you think about the first two series, you've got Rimmer, who is self-loathing, kind of like most negative about himself, and you've got the and you've got the kind of overconfident yet shallowness of, well, I mean to a point you can say that Rimmer's quite shallow in terms of how he approaches stuff, but you've got a very interesting spectrum of characters there. And I mean that character creation technique has always stayed in my mind, and it's something I've always thought about when looking at other series about how the other characters go around the kind of focus. So like Lister is like the quote unquote first build kind of focal point of the series. So naturally it feels like, and I think it was like when is it Dave Hollis, the original? He's based on that kind of story. So it's interesting that Rimmer and the cat seem to be those kind of very similar aspects, like kind of like over exaggerated aspects of this either self-loathing or the overconfidence that Stephen Moffat was doing when he created those characters in Coupling. And I only just clicked in during that conversation, but yeah, I just found that quite interesting.
So the boys go dive in, we're all guns blazing, but it doesn't kill the unspeakable one. Crichton warns that another barrage could cave the building, but Lister tells them to reload anyway. Rimmer is surprised that they'd risk their lives for him, and the unspeakable one flees. One question I wanted to ask you.
Is it my turn now?
Well, it wasn't that question, but yes. Okay. Rimmer says he's a virgin, but he's definitely had sex with Yvonne Magruder, hasn't he?
Yeah.
Boo. Continuity. Boo. We said we wouldn't talk about that.
I thought he said he wasn't a virgin. I might have completely misread that.
It came across as he was denying it, you know, doth protest too much kind of thing.
Right.
But you're right, he does say he's not a virgin. But I thought the impression of the way it was delivered was that he was delivering it in I'm not a virgin kind of a way, you know?
Mm.
Anyway, this is the first instance, I think, or maybe if it's not, it's the second, of one of Crichton's... What?
It's the first instance, I think. If not, it's the second.
What I'm saying is it hasn't happened much before. One of the old Android sayings, 00111001111111, don't stand around jabbering when you're in mortal danger. And I think it's the first one, isn't it?
I think series 5 really starts to... I think we mentioned it in the first episode. It starts to have these mannerisms or stuff that happens where you've got the... In the next episode, for example, there's the cat, Crichton, kind of comments and Crichton going back to Cat and saying, well, that's a really good idea, but for... And that's already happened, and we're going to get one next episode as well. So
yeah,
I think there's quite a few bits, the Space Corps Directive, even though it's been in, they're doubling down on that. So there's a lot in series 5 that's kind of, you know, formulating. Yeah. And we even get, you mentioned it, just popped in my head when you said it before. I was not going to mention it this time, but because I'm talking about this now, you mentioned Boys from the Dwarf, and that hasn't happened yet, but that happens next episode. It's the first time that gets mentioned, that they become the boys from the dwarf. So there's a lot in series 5 that kind of really focuses down on some of the aspects of Red Dwarf that we've not yet seen. But when you think back to it, if we thought back, you know, a year, 2 years ago, that you would think back to those kind of things.
Saying that, Kurt, one of the things that especially highlighted me when watching this episode was that and I think it's something that was like apparent in season 4, series 4, but it was definitely here, is just how much Holly's not needed as a character.
Yeah.
Because I think, and I think pretty much since Hattie Heybridge's and Crichton joined, where was, you can kind of see happening where a lot of the stuff that, a lot of the exposition that was delivered by Holly is now being delivered by Crichton. Because Crichton's now the exposition machine for stuff, particularly when they're talking about the Psy Moon. Previous seasons, they would have had Holly say that.
Yeah.
Whereas now, a lot of that need for exposition is coming from Crichton.
Yeah.
And I can't actually, and it'd be interesting when you, if you look back at this and try and find out how much Holly isn't in the episode and how a lot of stuff that perhaps Holly would have been able to do is given to Crichton.
I did think that exact moment you were talking about when I watched it this morning, the Psy Moon stuff. And I think because I've watched this episode and Quarantine together, that there's, which I won't talk about this week, but next week, there's some stuff that happens with Holly where it's like, right, it's because of the need for it, but also it has some elements which didn't happen earlier in Series 5, but we'll talk about that next week. So we'll park that one for now.
So they eventually release Rimmer and they escape and they head back to Starbug in the canoe. Rimmer complains about his day and they tell him about the fact that he's on a Psymoor, on a Psy Moon that is created because of his own psyche. He denies that he loathes himself and Crichton goes through a list of why. And I love the response. Oh, that. And Rimmer says that he's a mess, and then suddenly the quicksand takes a hold of Starbug. The cat suggests jet-powered rocket pants, but unfortunately they don't have any. And we're talking about running gags. I really felt like all these running gags had been established earlier, but it seems to me that all the running gags that are my vivid memories of Red Dwarf running gags are actually established in Series 5.
Yeah, because I think the rocket pants... I didn't realise was Series 5.
No, I mean more like the two small drawbacks thing. Where that running gag, we had our first one of those earlier in Series 5. The 00111, 00111, that's established in Series 5. Space Corps Directives is established in Series 5. I thought that they were all earlier than that, but they're not. All these running gags seem to be dropped in Series 5. Is that your memory of it, you two? Or do you remember them coming in Series 5?
No, as I said before, it's surprising. It's surprising that it's this late in the game.
So the Unspeakable One sends a message demanding that they surrender Rimmer. Holly suggests killing it, and Rimmer expresses the opinion that they're finished. The swamp further envelops Starbug. Crichton tells Rimmer it's his fault and insults him, and the swamp envelops further. It's at this point that Crichton asks for a confab with the cat and Lister, but not Rimmer, and the swamp envelops Starbug further.
What I like about that.
It's not really that subtle, is it?
No, but what but what I like about it is the, let me test something in a real world situation. And the way that Crichton delivers it, it's like, yeah, I think you can stop now, Crichton, because you are sinking even further. You know, there's no like, you know, panic on the face. Let me think about this. Right. You're a smeghead, Rimmer. Okay. That answers the question. You don't need to go any further than that. But I like that. I do like that. And I love the actual, even something as simple as when they were walking to the cockpit and Rimmer follows them and says, no, not you. And then it happens again. And I thought that was a nice touch, actually, because that where Crichton is doing it to prove his hypothesis, that isn't a moment. That's just a moment of like them just going, no, not you. And because they want to talk. And I like that, how they've quickly flipped that around.
So Crichton explains what's happening to the cat and Lister, and that basically Rimmer's mind is controlling the swamp and the Unspeakable One. So they need to make him feel good so that they can escape. As previously proved, his gratefulness and surprise at their bravery on his behalf was a much better weapon than the bazookoids against the Unspeakable One. And it's at this point that one of my favourite 3 seconds of Red Dwarf ever happens, where the door opens and the three of them give Rimmer that shit-eating grin. And every time, it just makes me howl. I love it so much.
It's a poignant moment. I think there's a few things that happen in this as well, where you've got when you've got the unspeakable one with oiled up Rimmer, that was heavily used in Press Junkies. So that was really like an image that people would remember well. And I think that image of them coming out of the actual cockpit is memorable from the actual opening credit scene, but it's also just a memorable scene as well. So it's a wonderful moment.
It is. So they go to Rimmer and they tell him they'll stick with him and that he's a beautiful person. They discuss how men hide their feelings and how much they care about him. Crichton says that he's a very good friend. Rimmer thinks that they're trying to shame him into sacrificing himself. And they go, oh, no, that's not true. And Lister has to admit that he loves him. And then they have a group hug. And in my notes, I've written, Rimmer's smile is everything. Credit to Chris Barry for getting his character so right. This Weasley man who's never truly felt that anyone has real affection for him, doesn't know how to react, and he puts on his best smile and it looks wank, and it's so well done.
You've missed a perfect cat moment as well when he says, it's true, they really do love you.
Even in mortal peril, the cat can't quite bring himself to do it. And that's really fucking weird, that it's the cat that has integrity and retains his cattiness when it's the other two that sacrifice their morals. It's fascinating, isn't it?
Mm.
Cats are consistent. My cat certainly is.
Well, yeah, absolutely, yeah. Again, I know, I think, have you covered this magazines? Totally by now.
We've covered the first 7 episodes. We've covered the first 7 issues of this magazine so far. We'll be doing 7 more after series 5.
Okay, because the talk about this end scene said that the fact that the only way that Rimmer was going to be saved was to release Starbug. And Rob Grant has said that, I thought the start of it came off very well. I really liked the stuff when they were in Rimmer's mind and the weird stuff with the gravestone. It doesn't end terrifically because they never really got that scene right. The part where they pretend to like Rimmer, and yet in the script it looked like it was going to work. So Rob Grant isn't overly keen on that moment. He says it didn't quite work the way anticipated, but I thought it works quite well.
I don't think I agree with that. I mean, it's his baby, and he certainly can have that opinion, but I really like this scene, the smile from the cockpit, the cat quote that you just said, and Rimmer's face is beautiful. It's everything, and Chris Barry is one of the best actors in the fucking world.
Yeah, and another moment as well, which is fantastic, which is obviously not scripted and not meant to be seen, is when he does like put his hand, when Lister does put his hand on Rimmer's leg, you can see Craig Charles is on the verge of going. He's literally, you can see in his eyes and his face that, you know, he's trying his best to hold back the laughter. It's a microsecond before they cut away from it. But he just puts his hand on there, and you can see it building. So I can imagine that, you know, that might have been take 5 or 6 or something. And it's like, just get through the scene.
So we cut to the graveyard, and self-confidence and self-respect both come back from the dead as musketeers from their graves, and they fend off, amongst others, mistrust, self-doubt and loneliness as Starbug escapes and clears the swamp. I like the musketeers. I like the fact that they dressed up Chris Barry like a right bellend and stupid floofy hats. I really enjoy that.
Do you think It's an interesting one, isn't it? Because Chris Barry is twice in this season pretty much naked in Holoship and this episode.
Yeah.
But yet they dress him up in the Three Musketeers outfit and he's got a red gingham dressing next week. So it's like, yeah, you can show off your newly kind of, or you know, the body that people didn't realize you had, but for price of that, you're going to be dressing up like this. I mean, I know he's game anyway, so I don't think it was ever going to be a major issue for him, but I just find it fascinating that, you know, they've gone to about two extremes with him.
There's lots of talk about how Robert Llewellyn suffered for his art dressed up as Crichton, but the way they wind up Chris Barry is just, I don't know, it does seem like it's deliberate, because it's always the Rimmer character that's in trouble. So, Rimmer asks if it was baloney to help them to escape, and whether or not they really meant everything they said, and in unison, they all say no. Which I thought was really fucking harsh.
No. But it's the timing on it as well, because it kind of, like, Craig, I always, like, hone in on Lister. It's the way that he looks at everyone else and then goes, no. You know, it's the timing of it. It's absolutely brilliantly timed. I love it.
I also think that they're lying to some extent. I think they do have a fondness for Rimmer that even they won't admit. Because the theme of the episode is admitting to yourself who you are and understanding yourself and knowing your limitations and helping each other to breach those limitations. I think there's, even in the final line, there's an element of looking at how people know themselves.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Because they don't want to admit that they meant any of it, even though they probably meant some of it.
Yeah, I do like there's a layer to it, definitely. Because at the end of the day, they weren't lying when they were actually in the cave. You know, the fact that, you know, where you cause you're one of the crew kind of thing. They didn't know it at that point. So
yeah.
they have to have that realization to be able to get out of it in the first place.
Yeah, and there's also the fact, I think, when, like, there's not really any hesitation from Lister that they have to go down and rescue Rimmer after Cats. I can't remember what the line is, but something like, doesn't he say something like, let's get popcorn or something,
yeah,
like that?
Yeah, it's a popcorn reference, isn't it?
Yeah. But Lister was like, no, we've got to go. So, yeah, which again is like, because as I think, was it Kurt or I said earlier that he's like the heart of the show anyway. Mm. So, yeah, and yeah, I think at least it kind of jumps into that. So there is a kind of level of respect and liking there, but it is a bit harsh, but I think it's also in character. I think it's also perhaps to stop Rimmer getting too cocky.
Yeah.
I think. Yeah. So I think if they answered that, I think Rimmer would probably milk it a bit too much, to the point where you'll see where a few days later, you can envision a scene between Crichton the cat and Lister. It goes, why the bloody hell did we have to say we meant it? He's been insufferable.
Yeah, true. So that's it for Terraform. And Matt, where can people find you on the internet?
Well, you can find me via my podcast on all social medias, which is Pick a Disc, where I speak to people about albums that they want to talk about for whatever reason they want to. Most of the time, or pretty much all the time, it's all positive reasons. You can find that on Pick a Disc, Twitter, Instagram, Facebook. Under Pick a Disc, it's all one word. So you can find me there.
Find me on the X-Files podcast, the X-Cast, which is the X_cast on Twitter. Or you can find me on Make It So, a Star Trek Picard podcast on Twitter again, and that's at Jean-Luc Poddard. Personally, if you want to see what I'm up to and what I'm tweeting about, where sometimes it'd be Red Dwarf, Star Trek, the lot, all geeky stuff, you can find me on my personal Twitter account, which is R Muldrake, which is at RMULDRAKE.
And if you're looking for me, I'm at Mark Adams HC on Twitter and Instagram. I also have other podcasts. I have a podcast about tattoos called Ink Stories. That's at Ink Stories on Twitter and Instagram. I have a podcast about Millennial Kids Telly. That's called Right in the Childhood at RITCpod on Twitter. And a podcast based around my job as a humanist celebrant. That's called Life's Milestones at Life's Milestones on Twitter. If you want to listen to any of the podcasts we've mentioned, all three of us, wherever you're listening to Shipwrecked and Comatose, you will find all of our other podcasts. Have a little search on Spotify, Apple, or whatever it is you are listening on. And that's it for this episode of Shipwrecked and Comatose. So until next time,
take that, self-doubt.
Elsewhere, and We Made This. Pick a disc.
The chorus feels like it's improvised as well.
It's improvised, like, but I also think it's like respect, because everybody gets a shout out. Busta Rhymes in effect. Shahid is in effect. Five Dog is in effect. And I think towards the end, towards the end, who's in the house? Ron Carter is in the house. So I kind of think of it, this is going to be very professorial sounding, but if you write a research paper and, you know, you put all your citations of your sources.
Yeah.
It's all the citations. These are all the folks that made this come together.
he's reading the Wikipedia footnotes for this song, isn't he? So
like 30, exactly.
20 years before it came in effect and stuff.
Make It So, a Star Trek Picard podcast.
To your theory, Gene Roddenberry, one of his golden rules was that conflict always had to be external, right? Like, it couldn't be internal. You couldn't have, the main drama being between the two people on the show. It always had to be humanity fighting outward, because we were already connected and we had already resolved most of those issues, right? And as Trek has evolved and we've started to incorporate many of the real life drama that can occur between actual people, which I think it's made the show all the better for it.
Yeah.
But I think you're on to something.
Right in the Childhood.
The big thing is, Raven has a vision that the job she was going for, she didn't get, because the woman says to Raven's vision, I don't hire black people. We cringed
that
time.
Just the fact that it was done with the actor playing the racist job assistant,
Chloe,
did it with real venom, and the kind of,
she did it throughout everything though. Like,
it was horrible.
She was not so subtle with how she felt about black people. Chelsea couldn't pick up on it.
Check out all of these shows and more on the We Made This podcast network.
Shipwrecked and Comatose, a Red Dwarf podcast, was created and produced by Mark Adams and Kurt North. You can find us on Twitter at Red Dwarf Pod, and we are part of the We Made This podcast network, which can be found online at wemadethispod.com or on Twitter at WeMadeThisPod.